Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I am your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today on episode 106, I am joined by three physicians in practice to discuss practice management pearls for graduating fellows and new attendings. I am joined by Drs. Ryan Isom, Will Park, and Chirag Shah now. Hello?
Hey, Jay, how are you doing?
Hello.
Ryan's here.
Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by three retinal specialists for this practice management tip session. First, in alphabetical order, we have Dr. Ryan Isom. Ryan, welcome. Tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Thanks for having me, Jay. So I've been out of practice for 5 years, going on 6 years, and I joined a private practice group out in Utah. It's Retina and Vitreous Surgeons of Utah. It's just a small private practice. There's three retina surgeons. We'll have our fourth one joining us this year.
Next in alphabetical order, Dr. David Wilkin Park from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Will, welcome back. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, thank you, Jay, for having me. I know that you allowed me onto this podcast just so that I could stay slightly ahead of Ryan in terms of number of podcasts participated in. But I'm in Minneapolis. I've been out about, Ryan said, it's been 5 years. We're the same year, so about 5 years out. I'm in a larger private practice, retina only, 11 people, and trained with Ryan in Miami.
And last but not least, Dr. Chirag Shah from Boston. Chirag, welcome, and tell the listeners a little bit about yourself.
Jay, thanks for having me. I'm the old man in the group. I've been out fellowship now for 8 years, and I'm practicing in Boston at Ophthalmic Consultants of Boston, which is a large multi-specialty practice. There's 8 retina docs in my group and probably about 32 or 33 ophthalmologists in total.
Perfect. So we've got a little bit of diversity here. And so what we're going to do is we're going to go through some basic questions and typical questions for someone who may be starting their practice as a graduating fellow this year or as a young attending out in practice. So Chirag, I'll let you start. So my first question is, how involved are you in determining your clinic schedule for a day and for a week?
So this might have to do with me being a little bit type A, like many retinal surgeons might be, but I do actually tweak my clinic schedule. I guess I should say I used to when I was first starting. So I adopted a schedule from one of my colleagues, Mike Morley, who I think is an extremely efficient retina doc. And then I took his template, which I thought was fantastic, which integrates injection patients into sort of established patients and new patients and consults and post-ops. And it kind of integrates all of that throughout the day, but very logical in terms of trying to have the morning be a little bit more injection heavy and have the new patients and the consults be earlier in the either the morning or the afternoon session. And then throughout the years, I've adjusted it as I've felt necessary. And now I'm at a point where I feel like it's a really good template and schedule, and it allows me to be efficient and spend more time with the new patients. And then the quicker patients, I kind of offset the new patients with some of the quicker post-op and injection patients, so I can try to stay on time as best as possible.
Can I ask you, I'm envious of you for a variety of reasons, but for this specific issue, I've tried so hard to micromanage my clinic schedule at various points in my career to have injections front-loaded or new patients at certain times or to preserve some semblance of a lunch break, and I have failed gloriously on all fronts in that front, and now I just pretty much just show up and just lower my head and go through
it.
Yeah, and I remain perpetually frustrated by the point that there are certain times during the day that I'm always behind. I'm always behind right before lunch, and I'm always behind kind of midway through the afternoon. And I just can't seem to schedule myself out of those midday slumps. And do you have that experience, or have you successfully smoothed those out?
No, so I guess this is the benefit of being the old guy in the group. But I've gone through all of that, and come 10:30, I would be 10 charts behind and just apologizing in the waiting room. And certainly I've been there. And then, in the afternoons, there was always emergencies that were getting added on that really screwed up my schedule. And so over the years, is there a electronic medical record that you use that helps with your medical record and your template, your scheduling template?
Yes. Yeah. It's got a separate scheduling template from our EMR.
Okay. We used to have it separate. It was called Intergy in the old days, and now it's all integrated in something called Epic. But the concept, I think, is the same, is that you have the ability to kind of visually see what the template looks like. And so I would just, you know, kind of constantly, at least in the beginning, make these adjustments to say, okay, I'm really getting backed up at this point. What is it that's backing me up? And I realized in the afternoon I would consistently get, you know, 5 to 6 add-ons that would often take a lot of time. So I just kind of blocked off spots for emergency patients. And then one thing I asked my team to do is, instead of just throwing patients in wherever for the emergency add-ons, to just put them on at the end of the day, and then I would just stay longer. And in fact, it made me less stressed, and I got out at the same time, if not a little bit earlier, because I was less stressed and getting all my notes done at the same time. But I think if you look at that template, and I would sit down with my administrative assistant and be like, okay, can we, you know, you can't put a new patient in at 11 o'clock right before lunch, because then I'll, you know, lunch is never going to happen. We got to make that like a really quick, you know, post-op or a quick injection. And then, you know, we made some tweaks, but we're able to keep our, we call it a cycle time, the check-in, the check-out time. We were able to try to make these tweaks to keep our cycle time consistent and low for patients.
Yeah, Ryan, my question, you're in a smaller practice. Do you feel like, do you have more autonomy over this? For example, do you or any of your partners separate laser or injection patients from regular clinic patients?
I do. I have total autonomy over my schedule. I can schedule it however I want. And when I first joined the practice, I just adopted what the other partners did. But then, as Chirag said, as time went on and I became more familiar with where I needed to change things, I did adjust my schedule. One thing, on Mondays, I was always getting slammed with stuff as well. It's always the emergency add-ons that really throw our schedule out of whack. And on Monday afternoon, I was always having add-on cases that I would do after clinic. And so I ended up just starting earlier. So now I start at 7 on Monday and I finish at 3. And then I've got a couple of hours to do cases right after clinic, which was becoming very common. And if I don't have anything, then it's just an early day, and that's okay sometimes.
Yeah, Will, Chirag brought up the issue of new patients. How does your practice distribute new patients when a patient calls in or is referred from an outside doctor?
For the vast majority of the time, we just distribute evenly. The front desk distributes without the doctors having any say in it. Obviously, if there's a specific situation one of us has a specialty or an interest in, then or a situation which the referring doctor very, very intentively asks for one doctor, we'll accommodate that. But we really try hard to kind of show and tell the community that we feel like all of the doctors are equivalently good at managing the vast majority of conditions. So we just kind of basically train the community to accept that they'll see one of us very quickly. It may not, but they can't necessarily cherry pick one of us. I think that was important. That was a big, at the time that I was interviewing for jobs, I was not a very, perhaps I wasn't forward-thinking enough to realize this, but this was said to me by this practice that I eventually joined, that's the way they distribute patients. And to be frank, I didn't really realize the significance of that. But I think it's an important thing, just because it's a reflection of the fact that the practice wants to have everybody do well and wants to have everybody be respected by the community in an equivalent way. And so in retrospect, that was a very telling sign that I just totally skimmed over at the time. But I think it's just an indication that the practice is trying to nurture everybody equivalently.
Chirag, is it similar in your practice?
Yeah, it's exactly the same. One thing that we do for new folks when we have new hires is that we try to make it where that first year, they all the new patient referrals goes to the new kid on the block. So that way they can try to ramp up their practice. And unless it's a direct referral to one of the other established doctors, it'll all go to the new person. But after that first year, it's equal distribution. We have 9 offices, so it's based on geographic preferences as well.
And Ryan, Chirag brought up new associates. So when you do bring on new associates, how does that fit into, and again, you're a smaller practice of 3 people and you're adding one this year. How does that fit into your overall model? How does your practice determine, for example, partner compensation, sharing of overhead? And is it, you know, people always talk about these two models. Is it more of a quote-unquote eat what you kill model or more of the shared communist kind of model?
So I agree with bringing on a new partner. When I came on, my whole clinic was mainly just new patients. And so we tried to really front load anybody who comes on new. We try and get them as busy as possible, as quickly as possible. And it's kind of nice to unload our own schedules. You usually bring somebody on when you're too busy. And so we will shift most of the new patients towards the new person as well. In terms of our compensation model, so on the partner side, it's an eat what you kill. So we just distribute everything in accordance to how much revenue each partner is bringing in. And for overhead, we share certain items equally, and then other parts are based on production. So whenever we're buying new equipment, a new Heidelberg or something, we all just split that cost of our capital purchases evenly. But for kind of everyday overhead expenses for payroll and things like that, we actually split it up according to production, which is good and bad. It's good because it makes it easy, because one of our partners is kind of half-time, and so he doesn't pay as much overhead because he doesn't produce as much. But it's also bad in that it penalizes the more efficient partners. So the more you produce, even though you may have the same amount of clinic time, be utilizing the same amount of resources, you might be more efficient and produce more, but be billed more in overhead. But we just kept it as a production-based overhead model.
Chirag, how does it work for you in a multi-specialty type group?
Our formula is pretty complicated, and I can't say that after 8 years I fully understand it, but in general terms,
it makes
it's
so much better, by the way.
We have many board meetings trying to explain it to us, and I still have a lot to learn. In general, it's an eat what you kill model for the most part. And you know, at the end of the day, we tend to have a higher overhead, and you Retina only folks might should be probably be sitting down when I say this, but our average overhead is somewhere, depending on the individual, is between 55 and more than 70%. So there's not that much wiggle room you have in your overhead, because all of us need a certain amount of rooms and a certain amount of technicians. But for the most part, it's eat what you kill with some level of complexity that is beyond what I can understand.
We talked about new associates. Will, for new associates in your group, or when you joined, one of the common questions fellows have is, how do I go about introducing myself to the community, or, you know, and becoming someone who people are comfortable referring to? How do you guys do that when, you know, I assume most of the people who come into your group aren't necessarily from the area. So does your group organize events? Do you encourage the associates to go out on their own and meet people? What is your practice's strategy for this?
Okay, I'll answer this, but after this, I'm going to hijack the conversation briefly to go back to something else that Chirag said.
I love it. Perfect.
And it drives Jay crazy. I love doing this. Yeah, we're fortunate in one specific regard that Wills has and a couple of places have that we still do the majority of our surgery out of a large eye hospital, which has the traditional surgical lounge like Bascom Palmer does. So a lot of my connections were made in between cases in the OR. And so what we basically tell our young surgeons to do is show up in the OR. You may only have whatever, four cases in the morning or something, but you're just going to hang out there in the morning and you're just going to see where I come in, and they'll curbside consult you, and it's a great way to meet different people in the community. And then obviously we do a little reception and for them in various locations of their clinics, and encourage them always, especially during that first year, to, you know, if you have a new patient, you're not that busy, you have a new patient come in from a local doctor, to call the doctor and say, hey, I saw your guy, I agree with you, they have X diagnosis, so that you're actually calling it later on. I'm not sure the doctors really want to hear about every time they correctly diagnose dry AMD, but at the beginning, it's good to have to have your voice on the phone with them. And I think that's been helpful. The phrase that always kind of comes back to haunt me, and I may have said this on a previous podcast, I can't remember, but it's hammered home, is that your local reputation is made in that first year or two. And so that's your year or two to take good care of patients, have happy patients, have happy referring doctors, and then you're good. If you screw it up in the first year, it's really hard to climb back from that.
So, and I'm going to hijack the conversation before Will can hijack it in his own direction, and feel free to hijack it once I say this. But Ryan, given what Will said, and Chirag, given what Will said about that first year, do you tell your graduating fellow, Chirag, anything different about surgically approaching things in the first year? For example, for that retinal detachments, do you tell them to be more conservative with tamponade or with the type of surgery they pick?
I do. So you know, I'm honored to be able to train four fellows. And so a couple of things I tell them is always do the definitive procedure. I tell them to really take good care of the patient and remember that when you're meeting a retinal detachment patient, for example, or a wet AMD patient, for example, it oftentimes it's the worst day of their life. And even if you're running behind in clinic and you're really stressed out, just take a moment to recognize that you need to, you know, connect with that patient. And that is actually a really great way to meet referring doctors, because if you have a patient go back to their referring doctor and say, man, this guy was empathetic and he fixed my retinal detachment. And I can see, I mean, that really says a lot, I think, to the referring doctors. A couple other pearls is for my fellows that are going to fellowship, I tell them, and this was told to me too, I tell them to try to not have their fellows do too much surgery that first year and try to do their own surgery that first year. One, because it's a lot of learning to relearn an operating room and learn new equipment and learn how to work with a new team. But two, you really want to keep your hands busy after a busy fellowship and establish yourself in the community. The last two things I tell our fellows is, especially that first year, to take as much call as possible. I've seen this myself, is that when you're on call and a referring doctor sends you a retinal detachment and you fix it and you do a nice job, that referring doctor will be like, oh, well, I'm going to send my AMD and RVO and diabetic retinopathy to that doctor. And then the other thing I recommend, especially when you have a lot of downtime in clinic when you're first starting out, is to put lectures together, just community education lectures. And then our practice does a pretty good job of setting up these CME sessions for referring optometrists and ophthalmologists. And it's a nice moment to, you know, get up for 20 or 30 minutes and educate them about advances in wet AMD treatment or whatever it may be. And then, you know, after that lecture, you can one-on-one get to know a lot of the referring doctors. So those are some of the pearls that tend to work for us.
Beautiful. Will, go ahead.
I'll just point out that just exactly extend one of those points, which those are all excellent points, is that when you're leaving fellowship, that's when you have a large repertoire of slideshows on really interesting pathology already at your fingertips, pathology that probably a lot of you know, community optometrists or community eye providers haven't seen. And so, like he's saying, you have these slideshows in your back pocket. You might as well use them.
Ryan, any thoughts on the first year out before we talk about Will's topic?
Yeah, I've got a couple. A lot of really good points there. Presenting to optometrists was one of the best things for me. And I've already set up our new retina associate to do a couple of presentations. And in those presentations, especially to optometrists, I always made a note to give my email and cell phone and say to contact me anytime if they have questions. And I get a lot of texts and calls now, and I've developed a better relationship with a lot of optometrists because of that. It maybe takes just a little bit of time to answer a text, but it's really nothing. I'm never inundated by texts or emails about things, but it's formed a much firmer relationship with optometrists being available. In clinic with new patients, I think scheduling the new hire at a slower pace is really good. Because of that, what Chirag said, developing a relationship with new patients, you really need to give a lot of chair time to new patients, even patients who are part of the practice. You're the new doctor and they want to get to know you. And so each visit is going to take a little bit longer. But if you can spend that time up front and develop that relationship early on, I think it pays huge dividends later on. And then surgery wise, your first year, I do think you want to be conservative. I remember Andrew Schimmel, his first year out, he did quite a few buccal vits because he didn't want to have any bad outcomes and develop a good relationship. And he had great outcomes that first year. So I do think being conservative, not trying a lot of new things your first year out is good. But that being said, I think at the end of your fellowship is when you do want to try a lot of new techniques and get those under your belt while you have supervision and help around so that you're able to do those when you get out and feel comfortable doing them.
Perfect. Well, what did you want to talk about?
Since I have Chirag on the phone, I wanted to talk about clinical trial recruitment. I know this is totally off the beaten path, but because he was talking about new patient scheduling. And I think we try and do a decent job recruiting a lot of clinical trials, but we're not OCB in that regard. And one thing I've started doing recently, and I'll just be curious as to how he or any of the rest of you build clinical trial recruitment into your practices, but I've tried to kind of monitor the new patients that go to each of our locations, to our doctors, and flag the ones that are potential clinical trial patients, and maybe shoot an email or a text to that doctor in that clinic and say, hey, you have three patients coming in who are decent neovascular AMD candidates, just to keep it on the radar for them. And I don't know if it helps or not. I think maybe for some people it's a little bit of public pressure, knowing that somebody knows they have a potential candidate coming to their clinic to maybe take an extra look at it. I don't know whether it works or not, but that's one thing that I started doing. But I'm curious as to what you all do to try to frame your clinics around potentially clinical trial engagements.
I think that's a really great idea. We have some study coordinators in our practice that do the same thing and just kind of flag that in our EMR. So that way the doctor can say, okay, this person might be a good trial candidate. One thing that I find really helpful for me, and I think it's been helpful for some of my partners, is we have a little cheat sheet that we have on the wall. So it gets emailed out every month with all of the clinical trials that we're currently recruiting for. And it has, you know, just really basics, like what's the disease, what's the inclusion and exclusion criteria, just really, really simple. And kind of, you know, is parking and transportation included? You know, how many visits is it for the patient? How much of a time commitment is it? And that cheat sheet's really helpful. So it's organized by disease. And so if I have a new wet AMD person sitting in front of me and I forget that we're doing trial, you know, X, Y, or Z, then I can quickly look on the wall, read their inclusion, exclusion criteria, check out their vision, which is usually the, you know, often a limiting factor, and make sure that diabetes and age, et cetera, are not exclusionary factors for them. And then I know that my spiel should include clinical trials in addition to the normal stuff that I talk about. That, for me, tends to be really helpful, and I think for some of my partners, just because it's hard to keep all the specifics in mind. And as you probably know, recruiting a clinical trial patient takes a significantly more time than just your regular new patient that you're not, you know, introducing a clinical trial to, because it's pretty hard, I think, just for patients to, you know, realize that they have a condition that needs treatment, and then to take it one step further and think about something that's somewhat experimental. So that tends to be really helpful in terms of helping me plant the seed. And then oftentimes, if they have to think about it, we'll continue the conversation on the phone, either that evening or the next day. And I try to line up phone calls on my commute home, so I can try to answer questions as, you know, as patients think about them.
That's a great idea.
What about patients who don't show up, Ryan? So if you have patients on your schedule who no-show, how do you handle that? How does your practice handle it? Do they automatically call no-shows? Do you flag certain no-shows, such as post-operative patients or patients you think are more critical, to track them down? What is your typical approach to those patients?
So I haven't been flagging. Certain patients I will, but very rarely. Some endophthalmitis or something like that, I will make sure that they call and get a hold of that patient. But otherwise, no shows, they just call the patient automatically and try to reschedule them, or at least leave a message for them to reschedule. The more important ones are retinopathy of prematurity, because both, I don't do any ROP, but my two partners do. And those follow-ups, they're very vigilant that if they don't follow up, then the doctor's notified. They still call and try and reschedule them, but my partners are notified if there's an ROP no-show.
How about you, Will?
Nothing too different. We, you know, on a very practical level, I group into three strata. One strata one is kids, post-ops, and then active tumors, uveitis, or high-pressure patients. Those are patients that, like, you know, their last visit, they had a pressure that was high, or they had active uveitis or some sort of tumor in the midst of management. Or obviously post-op, those I bend over backwards to figure out what's going on. And so, you know, call them multiple times and do what Ryan was suggesting to track closely. My second tier is chronic diseases like diabetes. Diabetes is the biggest one. You know, if they have DME and they missed their Q3 month visit, then we have a letter system that we send out, progressive letters of progressive urgency and certification. And even with a follow-up phone call after, I think, one or two missed letters or something. And then, you know, if somebody has a PVD and they didn't show up for their, you know, six-week visit or something, we're not quite as aggressive.
Chirag, how about patients who are repeatedly non-compliant? Or let's say a patient, maybe a different scenario, a patient who is aggressive or not courteous to staff or physicians. Do your practice ever dismiss patients?
We do. It's not very common. We have a compliance officer who's really helpful at drafting these letters to patients using specific examples of what they did that was not appropriate. And oftentimes, you know, patients will be, for these particular patients, will be inappropriate to staff, but then will be really nice to me, and that's that's not cool. And so we will send out, usually the first letter is a warning letter saying, you know, you did this. We expect a certain level of courtesy to the staff and to the entire team. And so we'll give them a warning. But then on occasion, I think in the last 8 years, I've maybe done this two or three times, so not very frequently. On occasion, we will send a letter of discharge and give them the reason we're discharging them, give them options of other doctors in the community to see with their phone numbers and then help try to facilitate a referral to somewhere else.
One thing I really miss about fellowship was that I looked a whole bunch like Ryan in fellowship. And so our physical resemblance allowed me to occasionally pass over one of those tough patients to his clinic without seeing nobody noticed.
We all noticed. Everyone noticed. Well, a couple more questions, then I'll let you guys go. Chirag referenced practice meetings. Everyone loves practice meetings. How often do you guys have practice meetings, Ryan? And what are kind of the common things people talk about in these meetings?
So we have a meeting once a month, but it's a general meeting amongst all the staff. So we just meet in the morning and everybody kind of goes through their own items. The doctors have points that they want to tell the assistants or billing staff or anybody. Everybody has their own agenda items that they want to go over. But I think most important are billing items or just kind of general housekeeping items that we go over. And then after that, the partners will briefly meet, but we don't really have a set partner meeting where we go over anything extensively. It's usually, because there's only three of us, a lot of times we'll just do it over the phone or even text if we need to take care of something. But once a month, we just have a general staff meeting with everybody.
Chirag, similar for you guys or different because of the multi-specialty component?
Yeah, it's a little bit different. So we don't have a monthly meeting with our staff. So I think there's about 33 doctors in our practice. And so the 33 of us will either meet in person or call in roughly once a month. And a lot of it's just housekeeping stuff and just seeing your partners face-to-face and getting through the day-to-day things that we need to talk about. Some of it is more external stuff like strategic planning and growth and recruitment and that kind of stuff. But we'll meet for probably 2 or 3 hours over dinner and then, you know, wrap it up and then put up an agenda for the following meeting.
Last question, which is kind of an open-ended question. You can take it any direction you want. I will start with Will. Any final words of advice, something that hasn't been covered for graduating fellows who are concerned about going to practice, joining a practice, building a practice, if they happen to be going solo, which is unusual, but some people do want to hang a shingle. Anything that you've learned in, over these 5 years that you wish you had known when you started?
Yes, I have two awesome points. I just want to say one other thing real briefly about your because you didn't ask me very rudely about the meeting schedule, the board meetings. the one comment that I would make on that is I think we do something very similar to what Chirag does there. Now that we have a fellowship, we've thankfully divested some of the academic. So we have an academic meeting, and then we have our business meeting. But even in the business meeting that's once a month, we're so caught up with the housekeeping, as you termed it there, is that that we oftentimes lack the patience to go over broader strategic questions, or it's late in the night, we've been there for 4 hours, we're all tired, want to go home. I was talking to Tushar Ranchot out in California a few months ago, and he does something which I'm very envious of, which I thought was a great idea, which was that they do a semi-annual weekend retreat, and they don't talk about numbers or HR issues or, you know, upgrading the computer system there. All they talk about is long-range strategic stuff for you know, a day and a half over a weekend, with, you know, a couple of meals mixed in. I thought that was a great idea. And I don't do that, but I think that's a neat idea to have a little more of a long-range planning session. But anyway, back to your question about young people joining jobs, the kind of on-the-ground practical advice I have if somebody is joining a private practice, I don't know if this translates to academics, it might, but certainly a private practice is that you should always certainly have a series of extensive conversations with the youngest guy in the group, because the youngest guy in the group is the guy who's going to, A, you need them on board if you're going to be hired. You don't want to have them thinking you're not needed. They're a good reflection of whether there's enough volume for you there and it's growing well enough for you. And they're also the person you're going to work with the longest, so you better like them. And then the only other comment I'd have, this is obvious, but I think it's really hard for us to kind of pivot what we think because we're so used to applying for residency and fellowship. I want to go into academics. I want to publish. I want to do this. You have to honestly, I think, look at what you want to do and be honest with yourself. And some people that do a lot of basic science, people that's fellowship education, some people that's just crank a clinic. But if you're not honest with yourself, then you can easily kind of be peer pressured into going one route or another. So my only advice there is just decide what you actually want and then go after that.
Ryan, tough act to follow.
So one piece of advice that I've done more is record more. So we were talking about presentations and things. You'll never have as many interesting cases or weird, rare, random things that come up as you do during training. And so I think there's no downside to recording as many videos as you can and getting good OCTs and good photos and making a collection of interesting cases. They may seem a dime a dozen when you're dealing with fungal endophthalmitis in Miami, but when you come out to dry Utah, it's not quite as common. So having those cases to present is really valuable later on. So you will be asked to present, and it's a good way to help build your practice.
In what sense did you mean the word dry Utah, just to be clear?
Well, it's categorized as a desert since we get less than 10 inches a year. But I guess according to that,
and their basketball team is still playing in the NBA playoffs, as is Minnesota's, but probably going to last longer, Will.
And, yeah, they're beating the Thunder. Don't rub it in.
Yeah, the Jazz are doing awesome.
Chirag?
I don't have too much to add, but the two things that I would maybe just add to this is, and I tell my fellows this all the time, is really make sure you communicate well to your referring doctors, meaning be consistent. And it's so easy, you know, these days to just send or fax in or email in a copy of your electronic medical record note. And it certainly does save a lot of time with dictation and money with dictations. But what I still try to do this because we've gone from dictating to EMR, I will try to write, and this takes time, but I will try to write a brief personal paragraph on top of my letter that I'm sending to the referring doctor saying, "Dear so-and-so, thank you for sending this gentleman for a CRVO. I treated them with Eylea, and I look forward to seeing them back in a month. I think their prognosis is good." Something really brief, just takes me a few seconds at the end of the patient encounter, and then my scribe sends it off. But I think that personal touch, and you know, in the old days, I would recommend dictating a really nice, you know, letter, especially in the beginning when you have time. But that personal touch, I think, can be really helpful for the referring doc. And then the only other thing that I would add that hasn't been mentioned yet is I tell my fellows, and I used to do this too, is I tell them to hold on to everything, meaning that when someone sends you a patient with 3 drusen or a benign nevus that's never going to go anywhere, I always offer that patient an annual follow-up with me so I can just keep an eye on it. And many of them, especially if they're coming from an optometrist or if they don't really have an established doctor, we'll appreciate that. And then, and that's one way to try to help grow your practice at the beginning of your career. And what will happen is you'll start grooming your practice as you get busier, and then you'll start becoming more diehard of a retina rather than maybe a little soft retina. But at the beginning, it's just nice having those patients to come back and start growing your practice.
And if I could just expand on that, not just for the reasons you just stated, but especially, like, I never understood why young people are so interested in sending out their post-ops and never seeing their post-ops again after month 2 or 3, because how are you going to know what percentage of your post-ops get a pucker a year after detachment surgery? How are you going to know what your rate of cataract progression is after your standard vitrectomy? It gives you a lot of information to have these patients come back at, you know, month 6 or year 1 after something that you've done to them. So.
And I always follow those patients. I was talking about, like,
the person,
you know, a trace CRM that will never progress. I'll also offer them a follow-up.
Yeah.
Well, Ryan Isom, Will Park, Senior Doc, Chirag Shak, thank you all for taking the time to do this. I'm sure fellows, attendings who are just out, and really anyone of any spectrum of training will appreciate this and the insights and experiences you guys shared. I will hopefully talk to you all again soon. I'm not going to any meetings in the near future, but anyone going to Vancouver of the 3 of you?
Nope.
Nope.
Yeah.
All right, Will, it'll be you and me.
All right. Hey, let's do a Vancouver podcast and just the two of us, just a little private podcast.
Yeah, we'll talk about Chirag and Ryan behind their backs.
With
and,
a Canadian accent. Yeah.
All right, guys. Have a wonderful evening. Take care.
Thanks, guys. Right, thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
As always, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's R-E-T-I-N-A podcast.com. All 106 episodes, including this one, can be found there sorted by category. You also find our blog, Equal Rounded Reactive, Lessons from Our Pupils. Also on the website, you can sign up for our mailing list to get updates on the most recent episodes. At the bottom are links to subscribe in the iTunes Store as well as Google Play. You can also like our Facebook page or find us in the podcast section of the iTunes Store and Google Play. We're on Twitter at Retina Podcast, and to contact us, click on the Contact Us link on our website or email us at retinapodcast@gmail.com. We really love getting feedback on things we can do better and things we are already doing well. We appreciate anyone who subscribes via the Apple Podcast app or Google Play to leave your positive comments in the form of a review. Many thanks to Drs. Isom, Park, and Shaw for joining me. Thanks to Louis Kai, Mike Benicasa, and Angela Chang for producing this great episode. Finally, thank you, listeners, for what you do on a daily basis, the patient care you provide, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.